sharing notes, and formed a respectful camaraderie. They'd come a long way from that first tense week.
Miss Reynolds?
Gretchen gave Laura a quick smile and disappeared into the office. Laura thought of the stack of paper that was her thesis, now sitting on Professor Wakeman's desk. She'd created that from nothing, and even if he didn't like it and gave her a low grade, she knew in her heart it was a valuable piece of reporting and writing. The school had taught her well and had given her a confidence that would serve her for years to come. Around 15 minutes later, Gretchen emerged, a huge smile on her face.
"It went well?" asked Laura, relieved. "Yes. He thought my profile of the mayor's wife was elucidating. I'm over the moon."
"Good for you." Laura had to wait another few minutes before Professor Wakeman intoned her name.
"Mrs. Lyons, you may enter."
Chapter 16. New York City, 1914. Professor Wakeman's office window offered a lovely view over an oval patch of grass where several of Laura's classmates lolled in the April sun. Laura peered out before taking a seat in the battered wooden chair beside his desk and waiting for him to speak. She wasn't nearly as nervous as she'd been at their first meeting, when he'd initially scoffed at her idea of profiling a women's club for her master's thesis. He leafed through a couple of pages before looking up at her over his spectacles.
"You took my advice and tightened up the middle, which I approve of. I like what you've done there, and the women's points of view are much stronger than I expected. You brought them to life."
"Thank you, Professor."
"I don't agree with all of their ideas, of course, but you presented the issues clearly and thoughtfully. The narration flows."
"I'm glad you think so."
"I also admire the way you included a section that gives the reader some historical perspective on the club."
"I thought that might help. You see, what these women think and say is quite different from their mother's ideas or their grandmother's. With the surge of interest in the life and rights of the common man, the worker, there's been a similar surge in the rights of women as an oppressed class."
He shuffled the stack of paper until the edges were perfectly even.
"Unfortunately, Mrs. Lyons, your grade is an F."
She must have heard wrong. "I'm sorry?"
"As I've said since the first day of class, a journalism degree is not one to be handed over lightly. Just as the law school students must pass the bar, we demand that any graduates of the journalism school pass a similar bar. You, sadly, have not."
For a moment, she wondered if he had mistaken her for another student, or mixed up her thesis with someone else's. But no, the pages in front of him were the very ones she'd typed up in Jack's office. "I'm sorry? How? You've said only kind things, and I made the changes you asked for."
"Your conclusion reads like an editorial in one of Hearst's slimy broadsheets. It's shrill. And even though it's just words on a page, it hurt my ears. This is not what we teach at this institution. You are not here to tell me what to think. Has that not been hammered into you in every class?"
As he spoke, splotches of pink emerged on his cheeks. Laura thought of Amelia and the pushback she got for standing up for herself and her work. This was no different, and she refused to step down. "You mean it offends your sensibilities? You don't like what you've read, and it doesn't agree with your morals, and so you fail me? That's not fair."
If Laura received a failing grade on her thesis, she wouldn't graduate. She wouldn't be one of the students standing out on that fine lawn. She wouldn't get a degree. There would be no job. The whole point of going to graduate school was to be able to land a decent job right off, not fetch tea for the top brass for 5 years and hope to land a scoop that impressed them. She sat back and clasped her hands on her lap, a ladylike gesture that seemed to mollify him slightly.
"Professor Wakeman, You've seen that I can report and write and edit just as well as the men. You know I can. Just because I showed some feeling at the very end of my thesis, I'm being punished?
Professor Wakeman tugged at his collar. Believe me, it hurts to do this. As you've been a promising student up to now, I know this is upsetting, but the school must maintain its high standards.
She laughed out loud, not caring about her rudeness. She'd been stupid taking this risk. She'd known about the low graduation rate, but had figured it wouldn't be her. Couldn't be her. All that money, gone. Wasted. She thought of her mother's engagement ring. Of Dr. Anderson at the library, who'd gone out of his way to secure her a scholarship. She'd disappointed all of them, including Harry and Pearl. Pearl, who she'd hoped would see that women deserved satisfying careers, just as men did. Jack, who'd be overly kind and understanding in a way that would make her squirm. She tried again, leaning forward slightly in her chair. You've said my work's been good and consistent. I've been out in the trenches with the best of the boys. Please. He gathered up her master's thesis and placed it on the desk in front of her.
I'm afraid not.
Let me ask you. How many other women who were under your tutelage did you fail?
That has no bearing on your case.
Tell me. Otherwise, I have the investigative chops to find out myself, you see. I know Gretchen passed. How many others besides me did not?
He tensed up. All except Gretchen failed. She did a lovely profile on the mayor's wife. There was no reason to fail her, none at all. No private agenda. It was factual, straightforward, and well-written. Delightful. I'll have you know that last year, none of the women whom I advised for their master's theses passed. So you see, there's been an improvement, Mrs. Lyons.
She didn't bother to hide her incredulity. Have the men been allowed to express their opinions in their writing?
He paused. It's different for them because their topics are more complicated. Politics, wars, economics.
So they've been allowed to editorialize? She waited. Keep in mind, the master's theses are on file in the library, so I can see for myself. He lowered his eyes, staring down at the sheaf of papers in front of her.
Some do, yes. But it's not the same.
How? He sputtered, then fell silent. You must change my grade, then.
I see your point. I do.
He shook his head.
It's too late to change the grade, though. It's been entered with the registrar.
Then my first article out of school will be on the sex discrimination rampant at the Columbia Journalism School. She snatched her thesis off the desk.
Rampant? No need for hyperbole. There's no need for that, Mrs. Lyons.
He touched his desk where the thesis had been, his fingertips splayed like spider legs.
I'm sorry, I can't change it. But I do appreciate you bringing this to my attention. I will certainly keep it in mind for next year. Will that do?
With that, she swept out the door, slamming it shut behind her. Without classes to attend, without a goal to achieve, Laura would be back to square one. Reading to the children at night, cooking meals, ironing and mending clothes. It was all she could do not to burst into tears when Jack opened his office door to her.
Darling, how grand to see you.
He closed the door behind her and gestured to the chair. She'd hoped he would take her into his arms, but he seemed unaware of her distress.
I have great news.
He took his seat behind the desk and finally looked up at her.
What is it? Is something wrong? The children?
He half rose from his chair, but she motioned him to sit. No, they're fine. It's me. I failed my master's thesis. Professor Wakeman failed me.
What? I read it, and it was wonderful.
He's known to be tough. Last year, he failed a top student for a mere spelling error. School of hard knocks and all that, I suppose. He liked everything except the very end.
I loved the way you summarized it. He's bonkers.
I changed it before handing it in. I added in my own opinions and thoughts. He didn't approve.
Jack frowned. What made you do that?
She wanted to scream. Because I had them, she cried. Because I felt they mattered.
Of course, that makes sense.
He rose and came to her, leaning down to give her a hug, as if it might erase his stupid question. She accepted the embrace, but pulled away first. What's your good news, then? We sure could use it.
The agent loved my manuscript.
He reached into a drawer and pulled it out, placing it on top of his desk.
There are some changes to be made, of course, but I agree with them all. They're going to make it even better.
That's terrific. I'm so proud of you. What's the next step?
I edit the book, then turn it back in. He's given me a couple of months. It'll be tight, but I think I can manage. After that, he'll send it out to publishers. He said he's already mentioned it to several, and they're all excited to see it. A bidding war is what he said to me. They'll get into a bidding war for your book.
He was like a child on Christmas Eve, beaming and giddy, and his excitement was infectious. She reached her arm across the desk and took his hand. Well done, my dear. You're going to be a literary sensation. Of that, I have no doubt.
I couldn't have done it without you, Laura, love. Don't you worry. We'll find something interesting for you to do. Something other than that journalism school.
The black cloud settled back over her. Like what? I even sold my mother's engagement ring. And now it's all for nothing. What have I done?
Don't fret. The book advance will make it easy to pay her back. She can buy a new one.
He snapped his fingers.
Hey, I have an idea. What about if you type up my edits for me?
Her heart sank. No, thank you. I don't want to be your assistant or your secretary. I want to write on my own. Do something on my own.
Don't get upset. It was just a thought.
That he would voice that thought out loud disturbed her to no end. He didn't seem to understand, after all this time, that she wanted a passion like he had. She would never have imagined asking him, if the agent had taken a pass, if he would like to type up her master's thesis for her instead, as if that might make him feel useful. It would never have crossed her mind. She excused herself and went up to the apartment, where her mother and Pearl were sitting at the kitchen table, sewing clothes for Pearl's doll. What are you doing home so early? Asked her mother. I failed. It's over. Where's Harry? What? Her mother rose and held out her arms, but Laura waved her away. She didn't want to cry in front of Pearl. Harry's off with friends. You had your master's thesis review today, right? I did. The professor failed me. For a senseless reason. We got into an argument about it, and to be honest, I think I won. But it doesn't matter. It's too late for him to change it. She sat at the table next to Pearl. I'm sorry, Mother, but we will find a way to make it up to you. Jack got good news about the book, and in a couple of months things will be brighter. For him? What about for you? Why did they fail you? Pearl asked. She sat very still. Her concern took Laura out of herself, finally. She put an arm over her daughter's shoulders and pulled her close, placing her forehead against Pearl's. I took a risk and it didn't work out. It was a foolish mistake. That's nonsense, said her mother. There's nothing wrong with taking a risk. I highly recommend it, whenever possible. Pearl, your mother is strong and will be fine. Taking risks is what life is all about. Pearl looked from her grandmother to her mother. But Mother seems unhappy.
Maybe for now, said Laura. But I assure you I'll be fine. That we'll all be fine. Grandmother is right.
The buoyancy of Laura's mother's faith in her future sustained her through the evening, but the next morning, Laura found herself standing dejectedly at the kitchen sink. She threw down the dish towel, took off her apron, and headed to the village to patch in place. Over the past several months, whenever Laura had discussed the thesis with Amelia, she'd provided a watered-down summary, one that lacked any specific references to the Heterodoxy Club. She didn't bother to elucidate further today, as it really didn't matter anymore. Amelia listened quietly as Laura told her what Professor Wakeman had done. The professor knew he was wrong, said Laura, her fists clenched in anger.
He knew it!
You should do what you threatened. Compare the number of women who failed to the men.
It would be a very small sample, and probably wouldn't prove anything. I suppose the good news is that, going forward, Professor Wakeman will consider women students in a new light, and think before he dismisses and fails them for something that he allows, encourages even in the men. I had the bad luck of the draw.
I'm so sorry.
Amelia reached over and gave her a hug, holding her close, before getting up to put another log on the fire and rejoining her on the sofa. They sat, side by side, staring at the burning log without speaking for a minute, and Laura's mind spun. How would her life change once Jack's book came out? Would they move from the library? Would he agree to move downtown? Every possibility nagged at her, and in every one, her wishes were secondary to her husband's. If she'd graduated, she might have landed a job and held some economic weight. The right to have an opinion. Without a salary or income of her own, Jack's desires were more important, even if he insisted otherwise. It wasn't fair. Her head ached. I feel like with every year, my brain is a sponge that soaks up painful experiences like water. So by the time I'm 50, I won't be able to hold it upright. Amelia laughed and turned to her.
What on earth are you talking about? You're raving mad.
You're probably right.
But I know exactly what you mean.
I knew you would.
They looked at each other. Amelia's brown eyes were soft and kind. Laura was glad she'd come.
So what now, Mrs. Lyons? Amelia asked.
Jack wants me to be his typist.
God, no.
Don't worry. I said pretty much the same thing. But I'm not sure what else to do.
You don't need a journalism degree to be a journalist.
It's going to be harder starting from the ground up. I have no experience, no published pieces, nothing to offer an employer.
You've got all of us, the club. We've got a lot of connections in newspapers, magazines.
I suppose so.
She hadn't realized until just now how wide her social circle had become. Maybe Amelia was right.
Hell, write a book about the women's movement. I'd buy it.
Amelia considered the world as if it were full of possibilities, not closed doors. Laura studied her friend's features in the firelight, the way her mouth moved, the curve of her chin. What Laura wanted, more than anything, was to sit across from Amelia all day, listen to her speak, and stare at her features, just take in her very being. The last time she'd felt this way was when the children were newborns, a rush of love, of devotion, that was unstoppable.
You are part of our family now, Amelia said. You can count on us.
Thank you.
Amelia closed her eyes and leaned back again, smiling. The temptation was too much. It was as if an invisible wave propelled Laura slowly forward, leaning closer and closer, until their lips met.
She pulled back immediately, the shock of the softness too much. But Amelia stayed still, placing a hand on Laura's arm, the gentle pressure leaving no question about her own desire. Laura kissed her again, and this time Amelia's lips parted, and then there was tongue and breath. A fire raced through Laura's body, from her stomach to between her legs. She shifted her hand from where it rested on Amelia's waist up to her breast, which was full and heavy. She dreamed of touching Amelia this way the last time she and Jack had made love. While her hands had stroked his body, her mind had imagined another silhouette, a woman's, Amelia's. Laura's love for Amelia, their friendship, the way their bodies moved, defied any kind of categorization. Over the past few weeks, the minute they found themselves alone, it was as if a magnet pulled them close, and before long their skirts and petticoats were mixed in with the sheets and pillows, two pairs of stockings lumped down at the very foot of the bed. They spoke quickly and easily around each other, interrupting and correcting, reevaluating their own positions and opinions. Laura had never seen anything of the sort between her mother and her father. Her father's desires always overruled her mother's, nor really between her and Jack. Jack was a traditional husband, in many ways, and made the lion's share of the decisions for their family. She hadn't noticed until now how much she deferred to his wishes, even if they came from a place of benevolence. They weren't equals, as much as she'd pretended they were. But that was no excuse for what she was doing. Every time she turned the corner into Patchen Place, Laura's guilt peaked into a sick panic. But then Amelia would draw Laura into her arms, and their inevitable dance of desire would unfold as naturally as a summer rain. Amelia stretched out on her stomach on her bed and ran her finger along the inside of Laura's arm, rattling off possible interview subjects for Laura's book. Marie Jenny Howe, of course. I'm sure we can get Emma Goldman if we approach her the right way. I'm still not sure. I've written articles, but an entire book? You have to stop doubting yourself, Amelia said, taking her hand and kissing each finger lightly on the tip. It'll be good for you to write this book, she said after. Get you out in the real world.
I am out in the real world.
It's way bigger than New York City, my girl.
Something in the way Amelia spoke caught Laura's attention. What do you mean?
You should come with me.
Where?
London. Amelia's lips twitched.
London?
I've been asked to move there in the fall, once my study here is complete. They want to try to recreate the conditions and programs I've set up here, in the East End, where they're battling similar issues with regard to infant mortality.
That's wonderful news. What an opportunity. I'm so happy for you.
No, you're not. Amelia knew her so well. She didn't need to explain, but tried anyway.
I am happy that you've been given such an opportunity. To travel, to have this recognition of your accomplishments. But I'll miss you.
Why don't you come along? Laura laughed.
Because I have a husband and children. Or am I supposed to bring them too?
I don't want to be without you.
This was madness. Exactly how do I explain to Jack that we must follow you across the ocean? He'd know something was going on.
There is something going on. I love you, Laura. The words she'd been desperately hoping to hear landed hard.
You know I can't.
Consider it, please. She shouldn't do any of this. She should return to her family and assume the role of dutiful wife and mother. She stood and looked out the window as if searching for an answer. But the cloudless sky overwhelmed her. She was exposed down here in the village. Or perhaps she was truly herself down here. Both thoughts frightened her. The horn from a passing automobile made her jump. Amelia came up behind her and wrapped her arms around Laura's waist. "You don't have to decide right away." More than anything, Laura wanted to lose herself in Amelia's scent, one that hinted of cinnamon and the sea, and not think about what the future held. Together, they retreated to the warmth of the bed and each other's arms.
Chapter 17. New York City, 1993.
Wait.
Sadie turned away from the cage door where she had been fumbling with the lock. Nick stood where she'd left him, hands at his sides.
Yes?
What's the book about?
She looked down at the worn cover of the surviving spinsterhood book, wondering what on earth she was thinking, finding comfort in this ancient volume. The world had changed, and here she was stepping back in time instead of moving forward. Studying the appropriate tipping etiquette for a lone woman traveler in the late 1800s, learning how best to budget on $60 a month. Useless knowledge, all of it. Her mother had been right all along. She handed it over to him, cringing inside. How pathetic she must seem. There was no explanation as to why she'd have the book in her bag other than the fact that she was deficient, a loser who couldn't hold a man. Or the book thief.
Any good advice inside?
He had the tiniest of smiles on his face. But not like he was making fun of her. Like he was curious. The author, Abigail Duckworth, says to find a passionate interest.
I like to dance. Check. What else?
Sadie rose to the bait. That every lady should have the makings of a Manhattan at hand.
Rye, bitters, and vermouth. Yep.
She wasn't called No Stumpin' Sadie for nothing.
Miss Duckworth suggests owning at least 4 bed jackets, including one of quilted silk and another in velvet.
He didn't even hesitate.
Check and check.
The incongruous image of Nick reclining in bed in a quilted bed jacket made her laugh. She regarded the battered volume.
I'm fond of this book. It's a quirky slice of history published in 1896, part of the original donation from the Berg brothers. Certainly not the most valuable, but still.
She paused, breathing hard like she'd run a mile.
I really must go.
His face grew serious.
Actually, I came down here to find you. Claude said you had headed to the stacks.
What is it?
Something else is missing.
God, no. From the Berg? Another book?
Not quite. A page from a book.
Which one?
Shakespeare's Folio.
Up in the Berg, Claude and one of their regular scholars, a rabbity fellow named Mr. Blunt, stood staring down at an oversized volume laid out on one of the tables. Mr. Blunt had been studying it for over 6 months now, part of a project with Harvard University, and he looked up with huge eyes as Sadie and Nick approached.
The title page.
It's gone.
She could see it clearly in her mind's eye. A portrait of Shakespeare, high forehead and lashless eyes, above which were the words, Mr. William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, dated 1623. So very long ago. The page had been cleanly cut out, only a narrow column remaining.
When did you last request this, Mr. Blunt?
She asked, her voice faint.
Before this morning? 2 days ago. You retrieved it for me.
This was more than an act of vandalism. This was war. Nick spoke up.
Tell me more about it.
The first folios, said Mr. Blunt, were published by Shakespeare's friends 7 years after his death in 1616. They're the closest thing that scholars have to his original works, since no handwritten copies survive. There are 233 in existence.
Sadie addressed Claude.
How could this have happened?
One of us has been in the room consistently, said Claude with a hint of aggression. I haven't seen anyone pull out a knife or a razor. Have you?
They were turning on each other and she welcomed the challenge.
Certainly not.
Nick broke in.
In this case, someone didn't take the whole book, just the page. Why would they do that?
I'm not sure, said Sadie. It's not like a rare map which can be resold after it's been cut from an atlas. This is just destruction, like the thief wanted to make a point. It's almost as if someone is trying to sabotage the exhibit. The folio was to be part of it, open to this exact page.
Nick considered her reply before turning to the patron.
Mr. Blunt, I'm a security consultant working for the library. Would you mind emptying your pockets and briefcase?
Of course not.
Mr. Blunt opened his briefcase and stepped back as Nick went through it, item by item, flipping through several legal pads filled with notes. Sadie wished more than anything that the missing page would flutter out, anything to have it back. Mr. Blunt also handed over his coat and emptied out his pockets. Nothing.
Thank you for your help, Mr. Blunt. Please, keep this to yourself, and I'll be in touch if we have any more questions.
After Mr. Blunt collected his things and left, Sadie locked the door behind him. She caught Nick's eye and tipped her head.
How about Claude?
How about me?
Claude's neck turned red with indignation.
How about you?
I'll need to look at each of your desks, said Nick.
In the back office, he started with Sadie's and, of course, found nothing out of order. Then Claude's, with both Claude and Sadie peering from behind his shoulder. When he pulled out the skinny drawer at the top, the one that held pencils and pens, Sadie let out a bellow.
Look!
Nick sifted through the detritus of erasers and nubby pencils.
What?
She plucked out a small plastic holder.
This!
You're mad,
said Claude, checking in with Nick to make sure he understood how mad she was.
It's dental floss.
Dental floss is a traditional tool of rare map thieves,
she addressed Nick.
They put it in their mouths and get it wet. Then when the librarian isn't looking, they lay it down on the page they want, right against the binding, and close it back up. After a few minutes, the page slips out easily, and voila, the job is done. Our map department bans dental floss specifically.
Claude slammed the drawer shut.
I had work done on my teeth, and the dentist recommended I use it after every meal. I can have him attest to that personally if need be.
They glared at each other, at a standoff.
Why would I try to sabotage the exhibit?
Claude pointed a finger in her direction.
You've been out to get me for the past few months. Don't deny it.
I have not.
She didn't want to get into it, not in front of Nick. But Claude was incensed, unstoppable.
We kissed once, at a fucking holiday party. Ever since then, you've been acting all weird, first happy and then mad, like it was some kind of big deal. It was a stupid, drunken kiss. That's all.
She stared at him, mouth open. His male vanity had been shot down when she'd rejected him, and now he was trying to pretend she was some kind of giddy schoolgirl. That was unacceptable. And mean. Her mind raced through responses, but it was as if she'd been rendered mute in front of Nick. Nothing came out.
Claude's eyes were hard, cruel. That's what holiday parties are for, letting your hair down. Although it was obvious you'd never done anything like that in your life.
He paused, letting the words sink in.
You're the crazy one, not me. Don't be putting this on me, no way.
Sadie grabbed her jacket from the coat stand in the corner, breathing hard. If she didn't get out of here, she'd fall apart. Her brain was spinning. Shocked by Claude's disdain and the terrible embarrassment of having had that discussion in front of Nick. Then there was the vandalized book on top of everything. But the appearance of Dr. Hooper in the Berg Collection's main room prevented her from fleeing. She nonchalantly draped her coat over the nearest chair as if she hadn't been running for her life. Nick and Claude joined her as soon as Dr. Hooper's voice rang out.
"I cannot believe we're dealing with another theft," said Dr. Hooper. "This is terrible. Sadie, you were the last one to handle this?"
"I retrieved it from the cage this morning, yes."
"Did you notice the title page gone?"
"I didn't check." It would be lunacy if the librarians had to check every page of every volume requested. Nick tapped his finger on the desk. His face was a neutral mask, giving no indication of what he'd thought of Claude's outburst.
"What if Mr. Blunt stole it and then pretended to find it missing?"
"Either Claude or I have been here. We would have seen it," said Sadie. "It's a small room. Any noise or odd movement would have attracted our notice, especially after the earlier thefts. We've been on the lookout, I assure you." Even Claude nodded in agreement on that. "Look," she addressed Dr. Hooper. "I strongly suggest that we get this out in the world. If you like, I can write up a press release."
"No."
The syllable erupted from Dr. Hooper, short and sharp.
"We're about to launch a massive capital campaign. The board does not want the fact that we're losing valuable items getting out, as it might give potential donors pause. It would mar the objective."
"Mar the objective?" Sadie couldn't help herself. "Our objective is to be stewards of history, and if things are being stolen, we're not doing our jobs."
"You're not doing your job."
Dr. Hooper stared hard at Sadie, then Claude, then Nick, like they were misbehaving students before turning on his heel and leaving. That was enough. Sadie grabbed her coat and left as well, not looking at Claude or Nick. Claude, because she already knew he had a smirk on his face. Nick, because she couldn't bear to see the look of pity that must be there. Pity at what an ass she'd made of herself, between the surviving spinsterhood book, her failure at her job, and that awful showdown with Claude. She mulled it all over as she headed downtown on the subway, staring at the filthy floor and strangers' shoes. She hadn't misread Claude's signals. He'd wanted to pursue the relationship with her after that kiss, right until she'd shut him down, hard, without an explanation. And even though her reasons for doing so had been sound, he was a big flirt, and other than work, they really didn't have much in common. The mature thing would have been to have a private chat with him. Either way, she knew deep down that she'd made her choices out of fear. Because after Philip, she simply hadn't had the courage to take any risks. The thought of loving someone again and then losing them cut her to pieces inside. She entered CBGB and asked the bartender to hold her purse and NPR tote bag behind the bar and pushed her way into the crowd. Even though it was early, some kind of band marathon was already in full swing. The kids on the floor didn't bother to make room for her, but that was fine. She wanted to have to force her way in, to be pushed by shoulders and elbows and arms, knowing that tomorrow's bruises would be the price of admission. The band members on stage were five tattooed skinny boys who screamed unintelligible lyrics to the appreciative crowd. Being inside the mob made her feel part of something, never mind the danger. She found her footing and bounced up and down in time with the bass drum, eyes closed, her senses on fire, filled with energy. The air smelled like cigarette smoke and sweat. She'd open her eyes for a moment and catch a glimpse of a nose ring, a tattoo on a neck, a bead of sweat rolling down the side of a cheek. It was as if the crowd were providing the electricity for the amps and guitars with its wild gyrations, not the other way around. Finally, after a few songs, she retreated to the bar. Nick was sitting there, waiting. She asked for her bags from the bartender and walked by him without saying anything, but he followed her outside. She whirled around, the cool air evaporating the sweat on her skin. She must look a treat, with her hair a mess, smelling of smoke and beer. "If you think I'm the thief, stop trailing me around and just arrest me or whatever you're supposed to do," she said.
"I followed you because I knew you were upset." He gestured toward the club door with his thumb. "You letting off steam?"
Exactly right, Mr. Tango.
Mr. Salsa to you. I think it's great. She paused.
You do?
Sure, it's anarchy in there. I like the contrast. Prim librarian during the day, punk rocker at night.
They think I'm a joke in there.
Tears came to her eyes.
Why was she telling him this?
Just like with Claude.
She paused.
This is all so embarrassing.
With Nick last night, first dancing and then talking in the diner, Sadie had opened herself up to the possibility of taking a risk. She loved how his brow furrowed when he was really concentrating, and the fact that he enjoyed poetry as much as he enjoyed tracking down thieves. She could continue guarding against betrayal and hurt by shutting herself off from even the idea of love. But in many ways, that was no different from protecting the folio from vandals by locking it away in a sealed vault, or attempting to protect her job by hiding information from the past that might be relevant to the present. It was time to come clean. No more secrets.
Can we go somewhere?
Sadie said.
I have something to tell you.
Chapter 18. New York City, 1993. Sadie and Nick walked up Lafayette Street and sat on the steps of the public theater. If she didn't figure out who was behind the thefts, if her reputation as a librarian was sullied, it would be hard to find work elsewhere. And then what would she do? I'm related to Laura Lyons, the essayist, whose husband Jack Lyons was a superintendent for the New York Public Library back in the early 1910s. They were my grandparents.
Is that so?
Yes. Lyons was my mother's maiden name. She spent a few years living in the library as a young girl. When I first came to work at the library, I was curious about the old apartment they'd lived in, what their lives were like. I did some research and didn't like what I found.
What was that?
That Jack and Laura Lyons were under suspicion for book thefts when they lived there. At the time, Laura Lyons wasn't the big deal she is now, so I didn't feel the need to mention it. But I recently found out information that was more disturbing.
How do you mean?
Apparently, before my mother passed away, she hinted that her father, Jack Lyons, stole a tambourine. I only just heard about this from my 6-year-old niece, so it's not exactly verifiable.
A tambourine. The Tamerlane?
Nick considered it.
So you think that your grandfather stole that book back in 1913? The one that's never been recovered?
To be honest, it's all really murky. My mother also said something about how they had to leave the library because of a burning book. I have no idea what that means.
Nick looked at her closely. What happened to your grandfather?
He died in 1914. There's a chance he committed suicide. She explained about the last entry in his diary. Stepladder, rope, note. Nick looked out into the street.
It's likely not related, but I need to pursue every angle I can, so you should have told me from the start. If there's anything useful there, I need to know it.
He paused.
You should inform Dr. Hooper of your connection to the Lyons family, I would think.
I will. First thing Monday morning. I promise. Nick stood. The conversation was over. She got up as well. It felt good to have this out in the open, finally.
I want you to show me everything you've found in the archives, he said.
That's fine. I'll meet you in the rare book room tomorrow at 4. Will that work?
Tomorrow at 4. And no more secrets.
No more secrets. On Saturday, Sadie and Nick set up a workstation at one of the corner tables in the rare book room. She showed him the note the library detective wrote to the director, the one that said that it was as if the thief had dropped from the sky. As he studied it, she asked if he'd heard any news from the bookseller.
The owner of J&M insists the books were sent by messenger to him, that he never met the seller. His instructions were to send the money by wire to an overseas account.
They fell silent as they made their way through years' worth of files and notes. Sadie gave a sharp intake of breath.
What is it?
Nick leaned over to see. I've been going through the 1915 correspondence from the director, in case anything had been mislaid. Something had. She handed it over to him. The detective's file from 1914 ended up there. The very first document was a note signed by Sadie's grandfather. It consisted of only a few lines, in careful cursive. I'm sorry for the trouble I caused the library. The fault is mine, as is the shame. Please tell my family I love them. Jack Lyons. Sadie sat back. It's a suicide note. Nick came up behind her and read it, then touched her arm lightly.
I'm sorry, Sadie.
So this means my grandfather was definitely the thief? It was more a rhetorical question, but Nick answered.
Looks like it.
That explained Laura Lyons's intense privacy coming off of a scandal like this. A family broken. And Sadie's mother Pearl knew about it all along. She sifted through the file. It looks like the books from the 1914 theft were also stolen from a caged-off area.
Where does it say that?
Here. She pointed to the page. It lists the original locations of the missing books, including the Tamerlane and a first edition of Leaves of Grass. She looked out across the room, lost in thought. Dropped from the sky. Nick looked over at her.
What?
Such a strange phrase, that it was as if the thief dropped from the sky. If we can solve that, maybe we can figure out how our own thief is getting access. She stood up, letting the answer wash over her. I have an idea. After returning the archives, she and Nick headed to the art and architecture room on the south side of the building. Sadie approached the desk and asked for any architectural plans of the library, waiting impatiently while the clerk fetched them. Sadie rolled them out on one of the tables. No good. These are too recent. You can see the stacks under Bryant Park are included. She turned back to the clerk. Are there any of the original floor plans, from when it first opened?
The clerk checked the records. There are, but you'll have to come back Monday.
He pointed at his watch. Closing time. They filed out, standing in the hallway as the exiting patrons streamed around them.
I'm sorry about what we've learned today, said Nick. I hope that isn't too difficult for you.
The signs were all there, so I'm not surprised. It ripped apart the family, and I can see how it affected my mother for the rest of her life. I'm just sorry that I wasn't able to talk to her about it, that she died before I figured this out. Nick gazed down at her.
I have to go, but I look forward to straightening this all out.
Me too. I think we're close. I think there's a connection with the past, and I'm going to do everything in my power to catch the thief.
Oh, I have no doubt of that. I don't know what I would have done without your help this past month, so thank you.
His acknowledgement of their partnership gave her a strange rush. She wanted to burst into tears and laughter at the same time. Instead, she offered up a sober nod. My pleasure. After he left, she finished up some paperwork at her desk, still thinking about the detective's letter. Dropped from the sky. If the thief didn't have the key, maybe there was something in the ceiling, some kind of hatch that he could access from the floor above the Berg's cage. She tried to picture the ceiling, but couldn't. It hadn't ever occurred to her to look up. The stacks, after hours, loomed large in the dim light from the windows, each aisle a narrow canyon of books. Sadie turned on the light and was about 30 feet into the stacks when she heard a strange scraping sound, like someone was raking cement. She froze, listening, scanning the space for any movement. But all was still. Probably just the library's ventilation system acting up. Anyone here? Her voice echoed around the stacks with no reply. She walked as quietly as she could toward the Berg section and peered around the corner. It was empty. Her nerves were just getting to her. She unlocked the cage and looked up, studying the ceiling. Solid steel. As she stepped back, still looking up, she almost tripped. The cover to one of the gray storage boxes stuck out partway from the bottom shelf, and she'd kicked it with her heel. She knelt down. Beside it lay the bottom half of the box. The label read, Jane Eyre by Currer Bell, Charlotte Bronte, first edition, 1847, 3 volumes. Yet only 2 of the small volumes were nestled inside. She glanced around, scanning the shelves, the floor. Nothing. The thief had been here, and might still be. Slowly, she rose to her feet, listening intently for any sign that she wasn't alone. She exited the cage, locking it quietly behind her. As she did so, the sound of a door slamming shut rang out. He was getting away. Sadie took off running down the aisle and back out the door she'd come in. She took the stairs 2 at a time, listening hard as the footfalls of the thief above her crossed the landing of the 2nd floor and kept on up to the 3rd. As she reached the landing, she almost tripped over something. The missing Jane Eyre volume lay splayed on the marble floor, like a broken bird. She scooped it up, tucking it into the top of her dress for safekeeping, before flying up the final set of stairs to the 3rd floor. At the very top step, her foot caught the riser and she was suddenly in mid-air before falling hard, her knee slamming down first and her hands taking the rest of the hit. The book flew out of her dress and skidded across the floor. It came to a stop before 2 pairs of black polished Oxford shoes.
Sadie?
Dr. Hooper and Nick stared down at her in surprise. Nick helped her up as Dr. Hooper gingerly picked up the fallen book.
What are you doing?
She couldn't speak. The wind had been completely knocked out of her by her awkward splat. She finally caught her breath.
I was down in the cage. The thief was there. I ran after him. He's up here.
Dr. Hooper looked curiously at her.
Are you sure? We didn't see anyone go by.
She nodded, still panting.
Yes, here, somewhere.
She ran to the door at the end of the hall that led to the art and architecture room. Locked. She tried the others on the hall, and Nick, following her lead, did the same on the other side. All locked. Only the women's room was open, and Sadie dashed inside, ready to corner her prey. But every stall was empty. She walked out, deflated and confused.
He had a good lead on me, but you must have seen him. We had him cornered between the 3 of us. Where did he go?
Dr. Hooper didn't seem concerned about the thief. Instead, he stared at Sadie, his jaw tense. In a rush, she realized what this must look like. A crazed woman in possession of a rare book, chasing an imaginary quarry. Alone in the library after hours. The thief.
Chapter 19. New York City, 1914. Laura cut through the catalog room, both heart-happy and heart-sick. Amelia wanted her to go to London, but it could never happen. In fact, Laura had vowed, only half-joking, to do everything in her power to get Amelia to stay in New York. This coming summer was all she had to convince Amelia not to go away, not to leave her behind. At least once a day, while riding the L or sweeping the apartment floor, Laura would disappear into a dream world where she could act on her wildest impulses, where she and Amelia would create a life together, Harry and Pearl in tow. Jack would be upset at first, but would easily find a new wife, one who was eager to fill that role in a way that Laura simply wasn't, and they'd all remain friends. But that was only a dream. Laura's mother had always encouraged her to follow her passion, With Jack, that had yielded wonders, including the children. Well, this was a new passion, one that she hadn't expected but wanted to explore further. Why not? Men did so all the time, with other women, with their work. Last night, Jack had explained over dinner that he needed to spend every extra moment working on the manuscript edits if he was to meet the deadline. That was his passion, his mistress. And Amelia was hers. Then again, how would Laura feel if Jack had an actual mistress? Another question she preferred not to delve into. He was a good man, and he would be devastated if he knew she'd found physical love elsewhere. She had to take time and figure this out for the sake of her children, her family. Amelia had suggested Laura speak at Saturday's Heterodoxy Club meeting on the issue of suffrage as a way to impress the members with her writing skills. Laura was excited to see what she could come up with. It was also a way to keep her mind from whirling away with thoughts of Amelia and how destroyed she'd be if their love fell apart. She filled out several call slips, waited for the books to be retrieved from the stacks, and took a seat at one of the long tables, eager to lose herself in her research. 3 hours later, her eyes burning with fatigue, she headed to the periodical room on the first floor. The New York Times had recently published an interview with one of the leaders of the New York suffrage movement, Mrs. Alva Belmont, and Laura wanted to refer to it in her talk. Jack had admonished her when she'd first stepped inside the periodical room and joked that it resembled the lair of a gout-ridden monopolist, with its dark French walnut walls and opulent doorway. On closer inspection, she discovered subtle surprises scattered throughout, like the pair of dolphins carved into the table pedestal and the ceiling panels that featured roosters and eagles. Since then, she never ceased to be amazed at the way the building's architects, John Mervyn Carrere and Thomas Hastings, had injected a refreshing air of whimsy into their stately edifice. You just had to know where to look. She took the remaining vacant chair, where the New York World, Joseph Pulitzer's newspaper, lay open on the tabletop. The same man who'd founded the journalism school. The reminder of her failure made her wince. As she went to fold it up and move it out of her way, a headline caught her eye. The Secret Club of the Modern Woman Revealed. No, it couldn't be. Laura recognized the first paragraph as her own words, then the next, and the next. The entire article took up 3 columns, far less than her master's thesis, but longer than any others on the page. Her work had been edited down to include all the more salacious comments of the women, and anything that put their words and statements into context had been cut. The end result suggested the Heterodoxy Club was a den of insatiable vixens, determined to overturn the patriarchal world order by force. At the very bottom ran the byline, "An exclusive to the New York World written by Mr. George Wakeman, professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism." The vile man had published her story as his own. If the members of the club saw this, they'd know she was behind it, or, at the very least, had supplied the information. She'd be cut off, reviled. She sank down in one of the chairs, not trusting her legs, her hands curled into fists. Amelia would hate her after this, think that she'd been using her the entire time, all in the hopes of getting a scoop. It wasn't meant for publication. Her voice sounded far off, like it wasn't her own, and was quickly answered with the librarian's loud shush. She gathered her things and fled. Laura arrived late to the Saturday meeting of the Heterodoxy Club, exactly what she didn't want to do. But Harry had complained of a tummy ache, so she'd given him a couple of digestive tablets before she'd left and tucked him back in bed.
Jack would be working in his study in the apartment all day and promised to keep an eye on the boy. Her hope had been to get there early and pull Amelia and the other members she knew well aside and explain what had happened. Instead, she walked in just as the meeting was commencing. Everyone in their seats, and Marie Jenny Howe, the club's founder, up front. To her dismay, Marie held a copy of the New York World in her hand. Laura had admired Marie for her calm demeanor during the meetings she'd attended, no matter how heated the discussions became, but now she turned to Laura with scorn. "The perpetrator has arrived." Laura spotted Amelia in the front row but couldn't meet her gaze. Her shame was so complete. Legs shaking, she walked to the front of the room, leaving a good 5 feet between her and Marie. "I'm so sorry. It was a misunderstanding," Laura began. But a woman in the back interrupted her.
"Get out. Or are you going to run back to your typewriter and write about this now?"
Marie held out one hand.
"Enough.
Mrs. Lyons, the rules were made clear to you from the beginning, that any discussion within this room is off the record. We did that so that our members could feel free to talk and explore radical ideas without having it skewed by the press. According to the members quoted, the information in this article can only have been provided by you, regardless of whose name is on it. You have misrepresented everything we stand for, everything we've said. What do you have to say about this?"
Laura took a deep breath. "My deepest apologies to you and to the rest of the membership. I wrote a story about the club for a class at Columbia, it's true, but it was never to be published, I swear. Without my knowledge, my advisor edited it dramatically and then submitted to the New York World under his own byline. I had no idea that this would happen. I respect everything that you're doing and fighting for and would have never allowed it had I known."
Laura stood there, waiting for her judgment like a criminal on trial. The exposure seared her every nerve, like she was on fire. "The damage you've inflicted on our reputations and our efforts is immeasurable," said Marie finally. "You are expelled from the club. You must leave at once." Laura did so, not looking at any of the members, but feeling every glare as if it were an arrow. She made it to the stairs and out the front door and paused, clutching the railing. What a mess she made of things, no matter what she tried to do. She'd burned all her sources and contacts for the book, for any future articles, in one fell swoop. She'd set herself up for this failure by falling for the allure of the forbidden, and had no one to blame but herself. Out on the street, a woman passing by looked up at Laura with concern, and she realized she was crying fat tears of self-pity. Laura brushed them away and tried to collect herself. The loss of the community of women stung hardest, as she had no similar role models in her life. They were taking a completely different tack from the other women she knew, and she desperately wanted to be a part of that sea change. Not anymore. All ruined. The loss of Amelia stung hardest. How she'd let her down, betrayed her, in front of all her colleagues and friends. Laura would never forgive herself for having caused Amelia pain. She started up the street, figuring she'd walk all the way home as punishment for her crimes.
"Laura!"
Laura waited for Amelia to catch up. The fact that she'd left the meeting to come after her, a courageous thing to do, didn't surprise Laura. That was how Amelia carved her path through the world, by never being afraid of what others thought or said. If only Laura were that strong. "You were brave to come, Laura."
"I had to. I owed them that much, although I knew it wouldn't amount to anything. But you believe me, right? That I didn't know it would be published? I swear, I just found out yesterday. The professor stole my article without my permission. Worse than that, he edited it to make it sound negative. Remember, I told you that he'd stolen the ideas of other students?
I remember.
Laura let out a sigh of relief. Thank God.
I don't forgive you, though. Her voice was cold, ferocious.
But I never meant for it to happen.
Amelia looked down at the ground, then back up at Laura, as if she were trying to compose herself. You never should have written about the club in the first place.
Laura tried to respond, but Amelia held up her hand.
You used me. You used all of us to impress your professor. Well, nicely done. That worked like a charm. He loved your idea so much he stole it. But it's still your fault, all your fault, that we're being vilified in the press. You set this in motion, not him. And what about the future of the club? What woman will join us and believe she can speak openly going forward? I'm so mad I could spit, Laura.
I'm sorry. I hate the fact that I disappointed you.
Me? What about all of them?
Yes, of course. But you, most of all. Please, Amelia, you have to forgive me.
Why?
The answer didn't come. Laura couldn't form the words because she knew it was all over from the way Amelia was looking at her, as if she was worthless, an utter disappointment. There would be no more conversations in front of the fire, no more kisses. She tried to remember their last kiss, but couldn't. How could that be? If she'd known it was the last, she would have lingered, drawing Amelia's breath into her own lungs. Shame enveloped her. For the past year, Laura had been searching for fulfillment and found it in Amelia and in her own work. Now both were gone, destroyed by her own hand. She turned to go, knowing that if she stayed a moment longer, her heart would blister and break. Chapter 20. New York City, 1914. Laura entered the library apartment, steeling herself to not fall apart amid the bustle of family life, and was taken aback by the silence. Maybe Jack had brought the children to the park, in which case Harry must be feeling better. In the kitchen, she was pulling items out of the icebox for dinner when Pearl appeared in the doorway. Laura blanched when she saw her daughter's tear-streaked face.
Pearl? What's wrong?
You're finally home. Where have you been?
I was downtown.
She knelt down in front of the girl. What's happened?
Where are your father and Harry?
Laura couldn't make out her response as Pearl sobbed into her shoulder.
Where?
Pearl lifted her head.
The hospital. Bellevue.
Laura rose abruptly. What happened?
Harry was sick. He went into a spell. Father raced out with him and told me to wait for you.
How long ago was that?
I don't know.
Laura took her hand. We must go now. After a slog through traffic in a cab and a dizzying run through the halls of the hospital, practically dragging Pearl behind her, Laura spotted Jack sitting outside a door. The look of relief on his face as she approached only added to the brick of guilt building inside her.
Is Harry inside?
She put her hand on the knob, but Jack stopped her.
We can't go in. It's not safe.
Why not?
Through the glass, she could see rows of beds filled with children, with only a few nurses flitting around.
He's very sick. Here, sit with me.
No, I must see him.
They won't let you in. I tried. Besides, it's locked.
She turned the handle to confirm it herself.
Tell me everything.
It's typhoid.
She shook her head.
That can't be. It doesn't make sense.
The drinking water for the library was brought down via an aqueduct from the reservoirs upstate and safe. A doctor in a white coat approached. Jack lurched toward him, grabbing his elbow.
Doctor, if you have a moment.
The doctor pulled his arm away, annoyed, and knocked on the door.
I can't talk right now, sir.
He nodded to one of the nurses inside, who unlocked it.
Can we please see our son? Laura asked.
The doctor barely glanced their way.
No, you may not. Not yet, anyway.
As Laura began to cry, the doctor let out an exasperated sigh.
Which one is yours?
Harry Lyons, Jack replied.
Right, just brought in. How long has he had a dry cough?
Laura thought back, relieved to have something specific to concentrate on. It had been before she failed out of Columbia. She'd been consumed with her thesis, and when Harry had approached complaining about a sore throat, she'd felt his forehead and turned back to work, determined to meet her deadline. She whispered her answer. About 2 weeks.
It slowly became worse and worse?